Trump's border wall is the immigration issue that gets most of the attention. But this spring, the government is also changing the rules for some foreign workers. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this Monday, we are talking immigration law on the show with local expert and attorney Giselle Carson. It's your chance to ask a question about this. Give us a call right now, 549-2937. Then later, Culpepper takes us down to the track as the Daytona 500 gets rained out. But first this morning, big changes are on the way to America's work visa program. The Trump administration has announced a new process to apply for what are known as H-1B visas. Now, these are coveted by highly skilled foreign workers, and they're hard to get. The border wall has sucked up all the oxygen in the immigration debate and the coverage around this issue, but this is an important story, too, and we're going to begin the hour by focusing on it and what it means for immigration, both around the nation and here in Florida. Giselle Carson is an immigration expert and attorney at Marks Gray here in Jacksonville, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
What are your questions for immigration expert Giselle Carson? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax, and our Facebook page is open. Okay, I guess we should begin by explaining what exactly is the H-1B visa?
Sure. So the H-1B visa is primarily used, or it's designed to be used, for highly skilled professionals. So these are our very highly skilled architects, our software engineers, our lawyers, our doctors. And interestingly, it's been capped for many years at 85,000 visas per year for the whole country.
So if you're highly skilled and you want to come in here on a work visa, only 85,000 such workers are allowed in.
That is correct.
Okay.
So let me kind of just put this into perspective. Sometimes giving an example helps. So just imagine that you're an HR professional. You have a busy life. You have many, many things going on in your daily work. You have a position that has been open, say, software engineer for over a year. And this is happening right here on the First Coast and nationwide. Now you have this engineer from China. Call him Lee. Lee applies, he's highly qualified, he comes to the interview, everyone loves Lee. And you go, yay, finally I can fill that position, we can, you know, move forward with this contract that has been pending because we just don't have enough, we don't have the right talent. Then you make the offer and you find out Lee is a student at UNF and needs an H-1B work visa to come work for you. So the manager is asking, when can Lee start? Lee's asking, when can I start? And you're wondering, what do I need to do? How can I get Lee a work visa? You Google, what does it take? And you find out, oh, there was only 85,000 visas. So I have to apply for one of them. Okay, so what does it take? Oh, wait a minute. There has been a lottery for this visas for the last 5 years. About 200,000 people have applied.
If you don't get a good lottery number, you're out of luck.
That is correct. So that's how we select, or that's how we offer work visas for highly skilled people legally here in the United States.
And this process has been criticized a lot.
It has.
Why is that?
Well, because, you know, thankfully our economy is doing very well, but we just don't have the right talent. And so these are not people that are coming to flood the U.S. market for our workforce. They're just very skilled positions for local employers and nationally. It has been criticized. So the other side of the story that you hear, and I agree, is certain contracting companies, so out of those 85,000 for the last few years, about 30% of those visas go to consulting companies out of India, which their only job is to grab and apply for those 85,000. So should we change the system? Yes. To make it even harder for those consulting companies, potentially. I mean, my clients need 2, 3, potentially 10 visas, and they cannot get them.
549-2937 to connect with immigration attorney, immigration expert Giselle Carson. Okay, so this is a tough visa to get, and there are new changes coming in March that you want to let people know about. What are those, Giselle?
So as you Google how to get this work visa for Lee, you not only find out you have to have a lottery, you have to win the lottery, you have potentially a 50% chance, but now you go in further, and this year you find out that the process has completely changed. And not only do you have to go through the lottery, but before you go through the lottery, you have to register a system that has not been tested before that becomes available March 1st. So you only have maybe 15 days to register to potentially go through the lottery. So just think it's April 1st. And IRS says, oh, by the way, Melissa, for you to file your taxes by April 15th, we have come up with this new app or this new electronic registration system that you have to use. So imagine the chaos, the stress, the uncertainties for people that are told about 2 weeks before that there is a new system coming on that really has not been tested for potentially 200,000 applicants or more. That's what employers will be facing in the First Coast and around the nation come March 1st.
Coming up soon. And why are these changes being made?
Well, the changes are being made because someone thought that if we go through this registration process, then maybe we can control better the process. And this was proposed last year, and USCIS decided they didn't have enough time to test the system.
And what was that acronym you just mentioned? USCIS.
Sorry. Yeah.
So that is?
The U.S. Immigration Services, so Citizenship and Immigration Services.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. I'm so used to using USCIS.
Sure. So what does this mean, Giselle, then, when we talk about immigration overall in this country, which is a contentious political issue?
Yeah.
And certainly the Trump administration ran and won on a platform of sharply reducing illegal immigration, but also what you deal with, legal immigration.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm an immigrant myself. So I believe the majority of the immigrants that come to this country, majority, almost 99%, are looking for opportunities for themselves, but are also here to contribute to this country. I have not worked with one employer in the United States, which is primarily my clients, that has said to me, I have hired a foreign worker that did not contribute, did not add to the diversity, did not add to the innovation. What that means for us is that foreign workers, I mean, this is a global economy. It's no longer just the U.S. economy. They are deciding to apply for jobs in Canada. They're deciding to apply for jobs in Australia. They are deciding, and I mean, and I'm hearing this all the time, they're going to Europe. So do we really want the innovation to move away from the United States?
What are your thoughts about immigration and how it should be managed in America? We'll go to your calls in a moment for immigration expert and attorney Giselle Carson of Marks Gray. The number to join us is 549-2937. You're an immigrant. Tell us your immigration story.
Sure. So I was born in Cuba, and my parents, when I was 15 years old, told me I was leaving to go for a trip for my 15th birthday. It was my, you know, sweet 15s, sweet 16s in the United States.
Quinceañera.
Yes. So I was a quinceañera, and I was going to Czechoslovakia.
Czechoslovakia?
Yes. It's a very complicated story when you live in Cuba at that time, and probably still now, probably worse now. You could only travel to
a Soviet bloc country.
Yeah. Okay. So Czechoslovakia was it. And the family, thankfully, was just my mom, my dad, and myself. Got on a plane. Again, I left Cuba, told my parents we're going away. I told my friends I'm going away. You know, I'll be back in 2 weeks. Yay. I've never been back. So that's the door that I still need to close at one point or another.
But so just, what happened when you got to Czechoslovakia?
Never. Have never been in Czechoslovakia.
Where'd you go?
So the plane landed in Canada. I'm in Montreal to refuel. And my parents requested asylum. So I've been through this process myself.
So your parents fled Castro's Cuba.
That is correct.
When I was 15 years old. Requested asylum in Montreal when you were 15 years old. And you've never been back to Cuba since. Is that right?
That is correct.
And then how did you make your way from Canada to the U.S.?
Yeah. So in Canada, I went through the asylum process, which is changing in the United States as we speak. Became a Canadian citizen, was unable to travel for many years because I had no passport. The Canadian government took my passport. So I lived there for about 10 years, went through the whole process to become a legal landed immigrant, which is Canadian green card. Then became a Canadian citizen, have a bachelor's degree from McGill, and
McGill University in Toronto.
In Montreal.
Montreal.
Yeah. Learned French while I was there. Huh. And then, look at the climate. Right now, they're covered with the snow. So I was taking trips to Florida where I have family. And then, my husband is Canadian and decided, I told Jeff, what do you think? Canada, what can we vacation in Canada, lived in Florida? So thankfully he said, yeah, we can do that. So started over again, came to Florida on a TN visa, which is the equivalent of an H-1B for Canadians, then moved to an H-1B visa, which is a more stable work visa, green card. Then I've been a U.S. citizen for many, many years, chose the First Coast because of our quality of life. Mm. My husband said, Miami, no way. Mm. So here we are. So I've been through the process. I know
twice.
Yeah.
And you deal with people who are trying to obtain work visas to come to America legally and contribute, which is a different aspect of this immigration argument America is having than the debate over migrants at the southern border who are fleeing drug dealers and violence and poverty and coming here and crossing the border illegally.
Right.
There's more to this than that piece of it.
Absolutely.
Which is why I'm so glad you could join us today, because this is a complex series of parts.
Yeah. There is no, and this is why, we've talked about comprehensive immigration reform, CIR, in this country for many years now. I still remember Senator Martinez from Florida, 10 years ago? Talking about this, and Senator Rubio, and trying to push comprehensive immigration reform. But there is so much at stake. Their emotions, their families, their work, it's a huge issue. So that's why we haven't made progress and we keep on going back and forth. But right now, I think where we are, at least from the aspect of legal immigration, we're truly harming our economy with the process that we have right now. And my employers don't mind paying to get the visa. Just tell me what it is and allow me to get there. But we don't have that.
All right, let's go to some calls now for Giselle Carson. 549-2937. Ava is on the north side. Hi, Ava. Good morning.
Hi. So I've listened to this HB1 debate on several different platforms, and I'm always confused because I was an IT professional for 13 years before myself and many of my fellow employees were downsized, laid off, outsourced, and friends that I have that still work in IT still face that issue today. And yet at the same time, they are consistently bringing in HB1 visas to replace us. So it's odd to me when they say in America, we can't find, these professionals. And when young people say to me, oh, I want to, go into IT, I'm not sure what to say. And even my friends who are still there who have gone through their layoffs and so forth and stayed in the industry, they say the same thing. They're not sure what to tell them because it is not a secure job.
Right, Ava.
and being outsourced and laid off. I don't understand. I don't understand why, what's happening.
Thanks for that. And I think she reflects the anxieties of a lot of workers out there, Giselle.
Yeah.
They resent companies bringing in foreign workers to do a job for less or even having them do it remotely from India.
I agree.
So what about that?
Yeah. Eva, thank you so much for the call. And I agree with your criticism. In fact, my cousin is an engineer. So he's when we have these talks, it's not, he sees it from your side. And I've tried to, you know, I explain what I'm going to explain to you. And I've mentioned before, there's 85,000 of these H-1B visas. So unfortunately, 30% of them are going and still going and most likely will go this year to these contracting companies out of India. And they are bringing in workers, totally agree with you, that are not being paid what they should be paid. They are promised a job that they're not getting. They're moving around the United States like, you know, they're in the First Coast for a few months. They're going somewhere and they're taking some of those U.S. workers' jobs. So that is a problem with this H-1B visa. I totally agree. My comment on this is the government knows which companies are doing this. The U.S. employers that are filing these H-1B visas are paying $500 in addition to the filing fees for our government to have a pool of money to go after the fraud that is being committed with the H-1B visas. That, I think, is where we should go because the positions are open, at least right now. And again, the economy has gone through ups and downs through all of this process. So what we should do is target those companies that are abusing the system and are abusing the employee. These employees from India, which I talked to, because they're applying for some of the jobs that my clients have. And when I talk to them, they're not happy with their jobs. They're not being given the positions that they're promised. That's a problem. And that's, to me, is anti-American.
Lewis in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Lewis. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering, for students like Lee, who Giselle was talking about, maybe they're coming in from China or other countries, they want to stay in the U.S. and get a job after they complete their degree, what are their options? I know there's things like OPT or optional practical training, there's H-1B, there's green cards. What's the differences in application process, in success rates, in costs and various restrictions for students who are interested in those processes?
Okay, Lewis, thank you for that question. Giselle.
Lewis, an awesome and a very advanced immigration question. So you know what you're asking. And thank you for that question, because what is going to happen for Lee, if he is not able to get, if his employer is not able to get an H-1B visa when, you know, in March or April when they become available, he will either have to go to OPT or CPT, and I will explain that, or a green card, and I will explain that.
What's OPT?
Yeah. So OPT is optional practical training. So someone that graduates from university, again, JU, UNF, they will have, so they finished, let's say, the U.S. master's degree. They will have 1 year of OPT, optional practical training, to train in the United States under an employment visa. They're still students, but they can work for a U.S. employer. And that's how Lee could apply to work for an employer and train. If he does not get that H-1B visa, he could go back to school under CPT, Curriculum Practical Training. He can work part-time and go to school part-time to a higher level education. Literally, I'm going to give you an example of one of many, local employer, a sponsor, a transportation engineer with a U.S. master's degree, apply for the lottery for 3 years. This engineer got a PhD waiting to be online to get an H-1B visa. So that's what most of the applicants that are in the United States as students are going to have to do and have been doing for the last few years to eventually get to an H-1B. In the past, I used to suggest that they consider the green card path because it was taking about 2 years and it was a fairly known process. So in lieu of going to school for various years, we could attempt a green card process. This currently, under all the uncertainties and the delays, is taking sometimes 10 years for someone to get a green card.
10 years, wow.
So the green card path, it's there, but it's really not a solid option.
It's 549-2937 as we speak with immigration attorney and immigration expert Giselle Carson. Carol is in Jacksonville. Hi, Carol. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for bringing up this issue because it has affected so many people in this area and throughout the country, really. Giselle, you had mentioned earlier that there is a Chinese student at UNF who has the skills that the employer is looking for, and the employer wants to hire him. My question is, why doesn't the employer hire somebody else from UNF? If UNF is preparing students with the skills that are needed by the local employers, then why would a local employer give preference to somebody from a foreign country? Why not simply hire an American who is also in that same program at UNF?
Thank you, Carol. Okay. And I think she gets at the heart of why millions of Americans are in favor of capping H-1B visas, reducing the flow of legal workers into this country. They would prefer an American to get the job. Can you explain why that doesn't always happen?
Absolutely. Carol, again, another advanced question. So the callers, Melissa, that you're having, it's they've lived or they know the system. So thank you so much for calling in and asking. So the scenario that I get primarily, so remember I said Lee has a U.S. master's degree. So this, again, I'm speaking from my experience and what I see my First Coast employers are going through, and I represent employers nationwide. So this is a scenario that is repeating. Many of them are coming already with a bachelor's degree from their home country. So my transportation engineer may have had a bachelor's degree in computer science. I mean, they're very unique combination of skills that I'm getting. So they're coming either with, again, a bachelor's degree in a very unique field from abroad, plus having worked in their home country for maybe 1 or 2 years. I'm going to give you actually a specific example that I'm dealing with right now. I have someone with a bachelor's degree in architecture from Iran with a experience in sustainability and disaster recovery work experience from his home country, very unique because they've been through, you know, wars and disasters. So he has his thesis was in sustainability and recovery design. And now he's in the United States going and doing a U.S. master's in urban and community planning. So that unique combination of skills is at least the population that I am dealing with that are applying for H-1B visas and cannot get it.
Okay. And so what I hear you saying, and based on your experience with employers, and I'm generalizing here, but it seems that in some of these cases, even though we're at almost full employment, that some of these hard-to-fill, highly skilled positions are just simply positions that foreign countries are better equipped to fill than the U.S. of A. And that speaks to our failure in America to properly educate and train our citizens to fill some of these highly complex technical, you know, high level positions. We are just not doing a good enough job of that. And foreign workers are better candidates. Great. That's what your employers are telling you, right?
Agree. And yeah. And I mean, and if you talk to employers, that's what they're going to tell you.
And so as a country, what we're doing, instead of better training our workforce, we're capping off the flow of people coming in from outside.
And the situation is even more unique right now, Melissa, and for your listeners, just because, again, we're a point in history, which, again, I'm thrilled that the economy is doing how it's doing. We all are. But But we, in order to continue to fuel that economy, we need the workers. And the other piece of this equation is, you know, we're not getting younger. And our population is aging. You talk to many employers, that's another issue that they're dealing with. There is a massive group of workers with depth of skills that are retiring. And mm-hmm. the babies are not there to replace them. And our students are not going into the STEM fields. So this is all adding up to the chaotic situation that we're in right now.
Let's go to some tweets and emails for Giselle Carson of Marks Gray. Here are just a few. William says on Twitter, because of the changes in technology, students from India, Nigeria, Central America, other places are future innovators for our nation, and we are missing out on opportunities to strengthen our economy and weaken our ability in cyber careers from these policies. The American government is creating an isolation mentality that is dangerous. We don't have the technical knowledge to remain a global leader for the future. Here's another tweet. I don't think most people can wait decades for someone to become a citizen. Years of waiting to get in, and even longer once they're here to get a green card. The entire system needs to be overhauled, he says. And on Facebook, a few comments from Susan. We need to develop the potential of our working population, eliminate the guest worker visa that prevents workers from fully participating in the free market. We need to increase work visas and fix the bugs in E-Verify. She also mm-hmm. says there are lots mm-hmm. of guest worker visa abuses by employers. They recruit hundreds of thousands of foreign workers each year to perform temporary low-skill labor in farming, forestry, seafood processing, landscaping, tourism, construction, and other labor-intensive industries. And so there are so many tentacles to this. We could go on all day, right, Giselle?
We can.
All right, here's an email for you from Mike. Could your guest expand on why she said there is no way she would move to Miami?
Well, let me retract that because my family lives in Miami. I didn't say that I would not move to Miami, but I truly love the First Coast. I'm a triathlete. Although it's getting harder to bicycle here and run and whatnot, but I truly enjoy the lifestyle that we have and I'm so appreciative for. So, and I love visiting Miami. In fact, I'll be there at the end of the month.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you too, people immigrating here from Cuba, mm-hmm. as you mm-hmm. and your family did, historically, there's been a different set of rules mm-hmm. for Cubans. Mm-hmm. What do you have to say about that? Yeah. There's this whole notion of the wet foot, dry right. foot policy. Can you explain why you had a slightly different process?
Yeah. So one thing I didn't.
You didn't.
I came via Canada. And again, I've gone through the legal system and legal immigration system in both countries. I am truly surprised that the wet foot has not changed.
And let's explain what that means, yeah. wet foot, dry foot.
So basically, if you're able to leave Cuba, which is extremely hard and you're putting your life at risk. And
you get in a boat.
You get in a boat and you come across the 90, you know, the miles. Many die, but they're willing to risk your life for better opportunities, a better life.
And if you make it to mm-hmm. Florida in a boat with right. wet feet.
Yeah.
Basically, the rule is they're going to take you.
They're going to take you.
They're going to accept you.
Right. And then again, it's not like you're granted a green card or that you're given a free pass necessarily, but you certainly, if you risk your life and you succeed, you have a little bit of a better advantage into getting into.
But if you're a dry footer like you, you go through a much more lengthy process.
Years and years.
Yeah. Sure. Well, it's been fascinating talking to you, and I encourage people to follow Giselle on Twitter as well. Giselle Carson with Marks Gray. Always good to get your insights on immigration. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Melissa, and thank you, listeners, and for your questions and feedback.
Later in the hour, Culpepper on a rained-out Daytona 500. But up next, it's a groundbreaking trial for heart patients right here in Jacksonville. We'll be right back.
Outdoor Lounge is now on Spotify. On the road or at home, take us wherever you go. Just search WJCT 89.9 on Spotify, where the Electro Lounge is always on.
WJCT invites you to join us for an evening with Ari Shapiro on Thursday, April 2nd, award-winning journalist and weekday co-host of All Things Considered, NPR's award-winning afternoon news program. Will join WJCT's president and CEO, David McGowan, for an engaging conversation. Visit wjct.org/events for ticket information.
Welcome back. Well, the Move It 5K is coming up Saturday. It benefits JAMS, the Jacksonville Arts and Music School. That's a creative youth development group providing arts education to students grades 3 to 10 through 10 from underserved communities. Here is Executive Director Jason Peoples with a little more.
So what is the Move It 5K?
So the Move It 5K is a really family fun event. It's a 5K, but it also has a 1 mile fun run. It's at the Calford Chop House. It starts and ends at the Calford Chop House. And it's a run that's actually benefiting the Jacksonville Arts and Music School, which is really, really cool.
That's a great cause. Tell me about JAMS, the Jacksonville Art and Music School.
Yeah, so the Jacksonville Arts and Music School, we're a creative youth development program that provides arts education and leadership development for grades 3 through 10. We actually grow a grade every year, and we serve the underserved areas of Jacksonville. JAMS is a youth development program, our organization that provides arts education and leadership development to students 3 through 10. We grow a grade every year, so that means we'll be in 11th grade next year. We serve the underserved communities of Jacksonville. JAMS works with students in areas of music, dance, visual arts, and film. We also have two clubs, which is the Robotics Club and the Taekwondo Club as well. And what we really want to do through those various mediums is establish trust, cultivate creativity, and develop leadership with our young leaders of tomorrow.
Excellent. So an easy way to support all this is to come on out. How can people be part of it?
The actual run is on February 22nd. You can go to the website, which is firstplacesports.com, and look for the Move It 5K event on there and register. You can also go to www.jamslife.org and find a link on the homepage to register as well. And they're also across all of the social platforms for JAMS and the Calford Move It event.
Again, that's coming up Saturday, the Move It 5K. Get it, cows, sponsored by Calford Chop House. Go online to First Place Sports to register. Well, February is American Heart Month, and it's no secret heart disease is the leading cause of death in the U.S. 200,000 patients are treated here with pacemakers every year, but 30% of them don't respond well. That's why Dr. Samuel Oza, Chief of Cardiology at Ascension St. Vincent's in Riverside, is leading a trial to test a new system. It's called WISE CRT, and it's the world's first wireless pacemaker. They implant it inside the left ventricle of the heart, and it was developed for cardiac patients who don't respond to traditional treatments. This could be a game changer for long-term survival rates with heart disease patients, and Dr. Oza is on the line. Doctor, good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
So Jacksonville is the first in Florida to offer this groundbreaking treatment for heart failure. Tell us more about it.
So this therapy is really, as you mentioned, groundbreaking. There's a condition in certain patients that have heart failure or severely damaged hearts where the walls of their heart don't beat in sync, and we call this desynchrony. There are traditional therapies that, quote-unquote, resynchronize the heart and allow the walls of the heart to come in and beat together in sync. About 30% of these patients with traditional therapy fail that therapy, meaning their heart function doesn't get better, they don't feel any better. Their valve disease, leakage of their valve doesn't get any better. And for those patients, there's very few options. Traditionally, a mechanical heart or a heart transplant would be their only options if that's available to them. Now with this new therapy, we're able to implant an electrode on the inside of the left ventricle rather than the outside, which is what we traditionally do. Because of this tiny, the small nature of the electrode, It can actually stay inside the left ventricle, which prior to this would have caused stroke if a traditional lead was used because clots can form on it. Now, with this device, about 85% of people can respond, meaning they can lead better, more fulfilling lives after this therapy.
And so this is, for local patients, could be a real game changer since you pushed pretty hard for this trial to be in Jacksonville. They don't have to fly halfway around the country for this kind of cutting-edge treatment. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, this was a therapy that, you know, I knew I had a lot of patients that would benefit from it, and we really had run out of options for them. Some of them wouldn't have qualified. Actually, most of them wouldn't have qualified for a heart transplant or a mechanical heart or anything like that. But this therapy would have been an option for them. So we really fought hard to get the trial here, and we succeeded, luckily.
Okay, so how is it going, and how are patients responding to this so far?
So they've actually done very well. The first patient that we implanted, he had a severe leak of his mitral valve, which is one of the valves between the chambers of the heart on the left, and that leads to symptoms of heart failure, which are shortness of breath. You actually blood pumps the wrong way, so you actually get fluid in your lungs and have much more difficulty breathing and exerting yourself and doing normal activities. And he had a severe version of this, which often requires open heart surgery to fix. After the electrode was implanted, not only did that get better, it went from severe to mild, but his heart function, he had severely reduced heart function. That also started to gradually improve, and hopefully it'll continue to do so. And most importantly, he was able to function at a much higher level. He was able to, perform all the normal activities of life, and he loved to travel, and he's able to start traveling again and spending time with his family and friends, kind of like he did before. So he was thrilled at the results, and that's not uncommon with other patients that we've implanted this device in. They've done very similarly. They've had improvements in their heart function, improvements in their quality of life, and all that.
It sounds like this is a lot less invasive, too, than, say, open-heart surgery, right?
Oh, correct. This is definitely much less invasive. You place a device on the outside of the chest, just under the skin, and then you use access from an artery in the leg, just using a catheter, which is essentially a needle stick, and implant the electrode on the inside of the heart. So, people usually are able to go home the following day.
And we're talking with Dr. Samuel Oza, Chief of Cardiology at Ascension St. Vincent's in Riverside. He's leading a local trial to test the world's first wireless pacemaker that goes inside the left ventricle of the heart. This is the first trial of its kind in Florida. So, Doctor, given all the advances you've seen over the last decade or so in heart disease treatments, where does this WISE CRT system rank?
You know, I think this is a great first step in the direction of wireless pacemakers and the ability for us to actually transmit energy into the heart and allow an electrode to convert that energy into electricity that stimulates the heart. Before, everything that we did required a battery attached to the lead. Now, because of this, we could potentially place an electrode anywhere in the heart that we want to stimulate. So that could really be a game changer. This device converts ultrasound energy back into electricity, so that can be transmitted anywhere in the heart. So this could be the beginning of many different types of therapies that would eliminate the need for wires going through the blood vessels into the heart, which can also cause problems.
Now, this trial is up now. Enrollment is happening through most of the year at St. Vincent's Riverside. You can go to ascension.org/Jack's Heart to register or try to register or call 308-6405. I'll say that again in a minute, Doctor, but, February is American Heart Month. You treat patients with heart disease. Let's, though, take a moment to talk about how we can prevent heart disease, which is the number one killer in this country. I don't want to put guys like you out of business, but let's talk prevention for a minute, too. Just all of the things people need to do to try to prevent heart disease. Common sense things.
Benjamin Franklin once said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. What we've been talking about earlier in the show is really the pound of cure. You don't want to get to that point. So the prevention is a lot easier. Things like diet, exercise, stress reduction, are all very, very important. And every study that comes out shows that they're more and more important than we even thought previously. So if you start early in life, you don't have to have severe, you know, drastic changes in your diet to actually live a very healthy life going forward. The later and later you wait in life, the more changes you have to make because you've already done damage. So, you know, most people, if they can start in their 30s and 40s to live a very healthy life, can avoid the heart disease that comes later in life if you make those changes. And by those changes, I mean with a diet closer to a plant-based diet, cold water fish, things that are high in omega-3s. If you're going to have meat, very lean meats, low in fat, but really focus on eating lots of nutrient-rich plant-based foods, whole foods, unprocessed foods, cutting out simple carbohydrates like white sugar, white pasta, white rice. Those are the dietary changes that people need to start trying to make even earlier in life. With exercising 4 to 5 times a week, 30 to 45 minutes would be ideal. And those are aerobic type exercises where you actually increase your heart rate and work up a sweat. Stress reduction, things like yoga, meditation, just simple as prayer, all those things can reduce stress in your daily life. And we found that stress really does cause actual organic disease in your body. So those are things that people might not take as seriously, but are very important. And then just relationships in life, having people around you that support you, having close friendships, close relationships with friends and family, that's also been shown to be very preventative of heart disease throughout your life.
All great advice. Thank you so much for that, doctor. He's Dr. Samuel Oza, Chief of Cardiology at Ascension St. Vincent's Riverside. This is a groundbreaking trial. You can register. Go to ascension.org/Jack's Heart or call them at 308-6405. Thanks, doctor.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
It is American Heart Month, so follow those tips to prevent heart disease, too. In a moment, the Daytona 500 gets rained out. Culpepper will take us to the track and have some other sports news and notes. That's next.
Dedicated to representing the injured people in Jacksonville for over 40 years. Learn more at farahandfarah.com or 396-5555. Farah and Farah's accident attorneys are here for you, here for good. Cypress Village, a continuing care retirement community, features resort lifestyle amenities which allow residents to remain active and vibrant. The new alternative to long-term care insurance, 901-4004. More at lifecare.brookdale.com.
On the next Fresh Air, did President Trump really call his top military commanders a bunch of dopes and babies? We hear from two Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters from The Washington Post. Philip Rucker and Carol Lenig did more than 200 interviews for their inside account of the Trump administration, which is titled A Very Stable Genius. Hope you can join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
The 70-year-old Jacksonville Symphony is one of just four orchestras selected to participate in the Shift Festival at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, will explore the history of the Jacksonville Symphony. We'll discuss the Fountain of Youth mythology and the impact of sea level rise. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Are kids being traumatized at school? Most today are expected to take part in active shooter training. But teachers' unions say it's taking a psychological toll on millions of children, and they're asking a key question. Do these drills work? I'm Todd Zwillick. Lockdown, school safety, and the impact on America's next generation. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT. Culpepper Sports Wrap-Up is brought to you by Farrah & Farrah.
Welcome back. Well, they'll have to wait to crown the Daytona 500 champion.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Culpepper takes us down to the track where things have been delayed a bit. Hey, Cole.
Yeah, that's right, Melissa. Rains yesterday postponing the Daytona 500 after just 20 laps were run out of 200. They're going to restart the race today at 4 p.m. with Ricky Stenhouse Jr., who was sitting on the pole when the race began, in the lead. So here are some of the important bits of information for those who are going down to Daytona for the race today. Parking will open at 11 a.m. Hospitality areas will open at 2. And then they'll get things going at 4 p.m. with the Great American Race, and we'll see how it all plays out. It's not completely uncommon in NASCAR for this to happen, but it doesn't happen very often for Daytona. And here we are at the 500, the first and most significant race on the schedule for the boys of NASCAR, and they'll have to run a little later today, so Speed Weeks goes a little longer down at Daytona.
That's right. All the fans are waiting for the big resolution. Okay, let's turn our attention to college basketball. What you got there?
Well, 2 weeks from today, we'll be in the month of March, so we might as well start looking a little bit ahead to March Madness. Melissa, as you know, it's one of my favorite times of the year. As a big college basketball fan, I love it when the tournament seedings start coming out and we start looking at the bracket. But before we get there, we've got to settle conference championships. And over the next couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks, we're going to start seeing those. Let's start with FSU. Florida State has an 11-3 record in the ACC, good for third place in the conference. They're ranked eighth in the country. They host Pittsburgh tomorrow. With six more conference games to go, Florida State has a real chance to win the ACC. They've got Louisville and Duke ahead of them in the standings, so certainly taking some opportunities to get some wins along the way is going to be very good for FSU. But even if they don't win the regular season conference championship, they are going to be a high seed in the ACC conference tournament. And then if they can win that, they'll be in great shape. Right now, according to some of the analysts, Florida State would be the first team out of the top two seeds in the NCAA tournament. They wouldn't be a one seed or a two seed, but they would be the next. They would be the highest three seed, which is particularly important. You want to stay in the top four seeds to get some geographical benefit, which would likely mean Florida State could start the NCAA tournament in Tampa Bay, which wouldn't hurt whatsoever. Meanwhile, on Saturday, Florida dedicated their basketball court to the name of Billy Donovan. The two-time national title-winning coach was there. It is now Billy Donovan Court. I think it's interesting to consider what could happen with Billy Donovan. He's coaching in the NBA with the Oklahoma City Thunder now. And, of course, over NBA All-Star Weekend, he was able to get away, get to Gainesville. A lot of pomp and circumstance, former players and so forth there to be a part of the ceremony. But if Billy Donovan either gets fired from or decides he doesn't want to coach in the NBA anymore, there would be an outside possibility that Billy Donovan could wind up taking a college coaching job and could wind up being the opposing team on the court at Florida. And although that's ever happened before, but it would be a very interesting situation to see what would go down there with if that were to happen. But a nice touch for the guy who is the best college basketball coach in the history of the Gators. The Gators, by the way, host Arkansas tonight in Gainesville on Billy Donovan Court. And then let's talk about UNF. They are 11-2 in the A-Sun Conference, a half a game ahead of Liberty, and they'll travel to Liberty on Thursday. Remember, they beat Liberty at home earlier in the year. They'll try to get a win on the road. If they do, it would really open up the door for the Ospreys to have the number one seed in the A-Sun Tournament. That is particularly important in the A-Sun Tournament because, unlike most other conference tournaments that are played on neutral courts, the A-Sun plays all the games on the courts of the higher-seeded teams. So if you're the number one seed, you have the chance to play every single game in your home gym, and that can go a long way to helping you get things done if you are UNF. So that's what's really facing the Ospreys now an opportunity to have a huge win when they play Liberty on Thursday.
And finally, we also had the NBA All-Star game last night.
And, of course, as you would imagine, there was a lot of sentiment and memorializing of Kobe Bryant throughout the course of the All-Star weekend, including Magic Johnson leading an 8-second moment of silence in honor of Kobe, who, as you know, wore number 8 as one of his uniform numbers. They also officially named the All-Star MVP trophy the Kobe Bryant trophy. So that is something that's going to live going forward in the NBA. But apparently the greatest thing that happened, or the greatest wrong that happened during the NBA All-Star weekend, was the dunk contest. And Aaron Gordon of Orlando losing out. He had perfect preliminary rounds. All of his dunks scored a perfect 50 points. Then we got to the finals. He scored a 47 and wound up losing. And according to my Twitter on Sunday morning, it was the worst thing to ever happen to humanity. I will say that it has come out that one of the judges was supposed to put a certain score up so that it would be a dramatic decision on who the winner was of the dunk contest. It would go down to a judge's decision, and somebody didn't do it. So maybe something else to just add some fuel to the fire that the NBA has always had a little bit of a fix in on some things. Again, it's the dunk contest, and although it was a very exciting dunk contest, some saying the best they ever saw, I'm an old man, and I will take dunk contests that involve, you know, Michael Jordan, Dr. J, Dominique Wilkins, and Larry Nance over just about anybody out there dunking today.
Excellent. Thank you, Cole. Thanks so much. You can follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Catch him most nights on Channel 4, our news partner. And I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for being with us this morning. If you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. Or all episodes also stream at WJCT.org. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. Let's connect again then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.